in The Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, and two Ransohoff films, The Americanization of Emily and The Sandpiper. While the latter film, co-starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, was being filmed in Big Sur, Sharon fell in love with the magnificent scenic coastline. Whenever she wanted to escape the Hollywood hassle, she fled there. Scrubbed of makeup, she would check into rustic Deachin's Big Sur Inn, often alone, sometimes with girlfriends, and walk the trails, sun at the beach, and blend in with the regulars at Nepenthe. Many did not know, until after her death, that she was an actress. According to close friends, though Sharon Tate looked the part of the starlet, she didn't live up to at least one portion of that image. She was not promiscuous. Her relationships were few and rarely casual, at least on her part. She seemed attracted to dominant men. While in Hollywood, she had a long affair with a French actor. Given to insane rages, he once beat her so badly she had to be taken to the UCLA Medical Center for treatment. LAPD learned of him from Sharon's parents. They also learned from one of Sebring's ex-girlfriends that he had had an argument with the hairstylist a few nights before the murder in one of the Hollywood discotheques. After checking the man's alibi, they cleared him of any possible involvement in the murders. The argument itself was minor. He had interrupted Sebring while he was trying to pick up a girl. Shortly after this, in 1963, J. Sebring spotted Sharon at a studio preview, prevailed upon a friend for an introduction, and after a brief but much publicized courtship, they became lovers, a relationship which lasted until she met Roman Polanski. It was 1965 before Ransohoff decided his protege was ready for her first featured role in Eye of the Devil, which starred Deborah Carr and David Niven. Listed seventh in the credits, Sharon Tate played a country girl with bewitching powers. She had less than a dozen lines. Her primary role was to look beautiful, which she did. This was to be true of almost all her movies. In the film, Niven became the victim of a hooded cult, which practiced ritual sacrifice. Though set in France, the film was made in London, and it was here in the summer of 1966 that she met Roman Polanski. Polanski was at this time 33 and already acclaimed as one of Europe's leading directors. He had been born in Paris, his father a Russian Jew, his mother Polish of Russian stock. When Roman was 3, the family moved to Krakow. They were still there in 1940 when the Germans arrived and sealed off the ghetto. With his father's help, Roman managed to escape and lived with family friends until the war ended. Both his parents, however, were sent to concentration camps, his mother dying in Auschwitz. Following the war, he spent 5 years at the Polish National Film Academy at Lodz. As his senior thesis, he wrote and directed Two Men and a Wardrobe, a much-acclaimed surrealistic short. He made several other short films, among them Mammals, in which a Polish friend, Wojtek Frykowski, played a thief. After an extended trip to Paris, Polanski returned to Poland to make Knife in the Water, his first feature-length effort. It won the Critics' Award at the Venice Film Festival, was nominated for an Academy Award, and established Polanski, then only 27, as one of Europe's most promising filmmakers. In 1965, Polanski made his first film in English, Repulsion, starring Catherine Deneuve. Cul-de-sac followed, which won the Best Film Award in the Berlin Film Festival, the Critics' Award in Venice, a Diploma of Merit in Edinburgh, and the Giove Capitaliano Award in Rome. In the news stories following the Tate murders, reporters were quick to note that in Repulsion, Miss Deneuve went mad and murdered 2 men, while in Cul-de-sac, the inhabitants of an isolated castle each meet a bizarre fate until only 1 man is left alive. They also noted Polanski's penchant for violence, without adding that most often in Polanski's films, the violence was less explicit than implied. Roman Polanski's personal life was no less controversial than his films. After his marriage to Polish film star Barbara Lass ended in divorce in 1962, Polanski became known as the Playboy director. A friend would later recall him leafing through his address book, saying, "Who shall I gratify tonight?" Another friend observed that Polanski's immense talent was matched only by his ego. Non-friends, who were numerous, had stronger things to say. One, referring to the fact that Polanski was just over 5 feet tall, called him the original 5-foot pole you wouldn't want to touch anyone with. Whether one was captivated by his gamin-like charm or repelled by his arrogance, he appeared to touch off strong emotions in nearly everyone whom he met. It was not so with Sharon Tate, at least not at first. When Ransohoff introduced Roman and Sharon at a large party, neither was particularly impressed. The introduction was not accidental. On learning that Polanski was considering doing a film spoof of horror movies, Ransohoff had offered to produce it. He wanted Sharon for the female lead. Polanski gave her a screen test and decided she would be acceptable for the part. Polanski wrote, directed, and starred in the film, which eventually appeared as The Fearless Vampire Killers. But Ransohoff did the cutting, much to the displeasure of the Polish director, who disavowed the final print. Though the film was more camp than art, Polanski revealed another phase of his multifaceted talent in his comic portrayal of the bumbling young assistant of a scholarly vampire hunter. Sharon, again, looked pretty and had less than a dozen lines. A victim of the vampire early in the picture, in the last scene she bites her lover, Polanski, creating still another monster. Before the filming was over, and after what was for Polanski a very long courtship, Sharon and Roman became off-screen lovers too. When Sebring flew to London, Sharon told him the news. If he took it hard, he was careful not to show it, very quickly settling into the role of family friend. There were indications, asides made to a few associates, that Sebring hoped that Sharon would eventually tire of Roman or vice versa, the presumption being that when this happened, he intended to be around. Those who claimed that Sebring was still in love with Sharon were guessing. Though Sebring knew hundreds of people, he apparently had few really close friends and kept his inner feelings very much to himself. But it was a safe guess that although the nature of that love had changed, some deep attachment remained. After the breakup, Sebring was involved with many women, but, as revealed in the LAPD interview sheets, for the most part the relationships were more sexual than emotional, the majority one-night stands. Paramount asked Polanski to do the film version of Ira Levin's novel Rosemary's Baby. The film, in which Mia Farrow played a young girl who had a child by Satan, was completed late in 1967. On January 20th, 1968, to the surprise of many friends to whom Polanski had vowed never again to marry, he and Sharon were wed in a Maud ceremony in London. Rosemary's Baby premiered that June. That same month, the Polanskis rented actress Patty Duke's home at 1600 Summit Ridge Drive in Los Angeles. It was while they were living there that Mrs. Chapman began working for them. In early 1969, they heard that 10,050 Cielo Drive might be vacant. Though they never met in person, Sharon talked to Terry Melcher on the phone several times, making arrangements to take over his unexpired lease. The Polanskis signed a rental agreement on February 12, 1969, at $1,200 a month, and moved in 3 days later. Though Rosemary's Baby was a smash success, Sharon's own career had never quite taken off. She had appeared semi-nude in the March 1967 issue of Playboy. Polanski himself took the photos on the set of The Fearless Vampire Killers. The accompanying article beginning, "This is the year that Sharon Tate happens." But the prediction wasn't fulfilled. Not that year. Though a number of reviewers commented on her striking looks, neither this nor two other films in which she played, Don't Make Waves with Tony Curtis and The Wrecking Crew with Dean Martin, brought her much closer to stardom. Her biggest role came in the 1967 film Valley of the Dolls, in which she played the actress Jennifer, who, on learning that she has breast cancer, takes an overdose of sleeping pills. Not long before her death, Jennifer remarks, "I have no talent. All I have is a body." There were reviewers who felt that adequately summed up Sharon Tate's performance. To be fairer, to date she hadn't been given a single role which gave her a chance to bring out whatever acting ability she may have had. She was not a star, not yet. Her career seemed to hesitate on the edge of a breakthrough, but it could easily have remained stationary or gone the other way. But for the first time in her life, Sharon's ambition had slipped to second place. Her marriage and her pregnancy had become her whole life. According to those closest to her, she seemed oblivious to all else. There were rumors of trouble in her marriage. Several of her female friends told LAPD that she had waited to tell Roman of her pregnancy until after it was too late to abort. If she was concerned that even after marriage Polanski remained the playboy, she hid it. Sharon herself often told a story then current in the movie colony of how Roman was driving through Beverly Hills when, spotting a pretty girl walking ahead of him, he yelled, "Miss, you have a beautiful arse." Only when the girl turned did he recognize his wife. Yet it was obvious that she hoped the baby would bring the marriage closer together. Hollywood is a bitchy town. In interviewing acquaintances of the victims, LAPD would encounter an incredible amount of venom. Interestingly enough, in the dozens of interview sheets, no one who actually knew Sharon Tate said anything bad about her. Very sweet, somewhat naive. These were the words most often used. That Sunday, a Los Angeles Times reporter who had known Sharon described her as an astonishingly beautiful woman with a statuesque figure and a face of great delicacy. But then, he didn't see her as Coroner Noguchi did. Cause of death? Multiple stab wounds of the chest and back, penetrating the heart, lungs, and liver, causing massive hemorrhage. Victim was stabbed 16 times, 5 of which wounds were in and of themselves fatal. Jay Sebring, 9860 Easton Drive, Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles, male Caucasian, 35 years, 5'6", 120 pounds, black hair, brown eyes. Victim was a hairstylist and had a corporation known as Sebring International. Born Thomas John Coomer in Detroit, Michigan, he had changed his name to Jay Sebring shortly after arriving in Hollywood, following a 4-year stint as a Navy barber, borrowing the last name from the famous Florida sports car race because he liked the image it projected. In his personal life, as in his work, appearances were all important. He drove an expensive sports car, frequented the inn clubs, even had his Levi jackets custom made. He employed a full-time butler, gave lavish parties, and lived in a jinxed mansion, 9860 Easton Drive, Benedict Canyon. Once the love nest of actress Jean Harlow and producer Paul Byrne, it was here, in Harlow's bedroom, that Byrne had committed suicide, 2 months after their marriage. According to acquaintances, Sebring had bought the house because of its far-out reputation. It was widely reported that a motion picture studio had flown Sebring to London just to cut George Papard's hair at a cost of $25,000. While the report was probably as factual as another also current, that he had a black belt in karate, he had taken a few lessons from Bruce Lee, there was no question that he was the leading men's hairstylist in the United States, and that more than any other single individual, he was responsible for the revolution in male hair care. In addition to Papard, his customers included Frank Sinatra, Paul Newman, Steve McQueen, Peter Lawford, and numerous other motion picture stars, many of whom had promised to invest in his new corporation, Sebring International. While keeping his original salon at 725 North Fairfax in Los Angeles, he planned to open a series of franchised shops and to market a line of men's toiletries bearing his name. The first shop had been opened in San Francisco in May 1969, Abigail Folger and Colonel and Mrs. Paul Tate being among those at the grand opening. On April 9, 1968, Sebring had signed an application for a $500,000 executive protection policy with the Occidental Life Insurance Company of California. A background investigation conducted by the retail credit company estimated his net worth at $100,000, of which $80,000 was the appraised worth of his residence. Sebring Incorporated, the original business, had assets of $150,000, with liabilities of $115,000. The investigators also looked into Sebring's personal life. He had married once in October 1960, he and his wife Cammy, a model, separating in August 1963, their divorce becoming final in March 1965, the couple having had no children. The report also stated that Sebring had never used drugs as a habit. LAPD knew otherwise. They also knew something else the credit company investigators had never discovered. There was a darker side to J. Sebring's nature that surfaced during numerous interviews conducted by the police. As noted in the official report, he was considered a ladies' man and took numerous women to his residence in the Hollywood Hills. He would tie the women up with a small sash cord and, if they agreed, would whip them, after which they would have sexual relations. Rumors of this had long circulated around Hollywood. Now picked up by the press, they became the basis for numerous theories, chief among them that some sort of sadomasochistic orgy had been in progress on the night of August 9, 1969, at 10,050 Cielo Drive. LAPD never seriously considered Sebring's odd sexual habits a possible cause of the murders. None of the girls interviewed, and the number was large, Sebring frequently dating five or six different girls a week, claimed that Sebring had actually hurt them, though he often asked them to pretend pain. Nor, as far as could be determined, was Sebring involved in group sex. He was too afraid his private quirks would subject him to ridicule. The mundane truth appeared to be that behind the carefully cultivated public image, there was a lonely, troubled man so insecure in his role that even in his sex life he had to revert to fantasy. Cause of death? Exsanguination. Victim literally bled to death. Victim had been stabbed 7 times and shot once, at least 3 of the stab wounds, as well as the gunshot wound, being in and of itself fatal. Abigail Ann Folger, female Caucasian, 25 years, 5'5", 120 pounds, brown hair, hazel eyes, residence since the 1st of April, 10,050 Cielo Drive. Prior to that, she lived at 2774 Woodstock Road. Occupation, heiress to the Folger coffee fortune. Abigail Gibby Folger's coming-out party had been held at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco on December 21, 1961. The Italianette ball was one of the highlights of the social season, the debutante wearing a bright yellow Dior she had purchased in Paris the previous summer. After that, she had attended Radcliffe, graduating with honors, worked for a time as publicity director for the University of California Art Museum in Berkeley, quit that to work in a New York bookstore, then became involved in social work in the ghettos. It was while in New York in early 1968 that Polish novelist Jerzy Kaczynski introduced her to Wojtek Frykowski. They left New York together that August, driving to Los Angeles, where they rented a house at 2774 Woodstock Road, off Mulholland in the Hollywood Hills. Through Frykowski, she met the Polanskis, Sebring, and others in their circle. She was one of the investors in Sebring International. Shortly after arriving in Southern California, she registered as a volunteer social worker for the Los Angeles County Welfare Department and would get up at dawn each day for assignments that took her into Watts, Pacoima, and other ghetto areas. She continued this work until the day before she and Frykowski moved into 10,050 Cielo Drive. Something changed after that. Probably it was a combination of things. She became depressed over how little such work actually accomplished, how big the problems stayed. A lot of social workers go home at night, take a bath, and wash off their day, she told an old San Francisco friend. I can't. The suffering gets under your skin. In May, Black City Councilman Thomas Bradley ran against incumbent Samuel Yordi for mayor of Los Angeles. Bradley's defeat, after a campaign heavy with racial smears, left her disillusioned and bitter. She did not resume her social work. She was also disturbed about the way her affair with Frykowski was going, and with their use of drugs, which had passed the point of experimentation. She talked about all these things with her psychiatrist, Dr. Marvin Flicker. She saw him 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, at 4:30 p.m. She had kept her appointment that Friday. Flicker told the police that he thought Abigail was almost ready to leave Frykowski, that she was attempting to build up enough nerve to go it alone. The police were unable to determine exactly when Folger and Frykowski began to use drugs heavily on a regular basis. It was learned that on their cross-country trip they had stopped in Irving, Texas, staying several days with a big dope dealer well known to local and Dallas police. Dealers were among their regular guests both at the Woodstock House and after they moved to Cielo Drive. William Tennant told police that whenever he visited the latter residence, Abigail always seemed to be in a stupor from narcotics. When her mother last talked to her, about 10 that Friday night, she said Gibby had sounded lucid but a little high. Mrs. Folger, who was not unaware of her daughter's problems, had contributed large amounts of both money and time to the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic to help in their pioneer work in treating drug abuse. The coroners discovered 2.4 milligrams of methylene dioxyamphetamine, MDA, in Abigail Folger's system. That this was a larger amount than was found in Wojtek Frykowski's body, 0.6 milligrams, did not necessarily indicate that she had taken a larger quantity of the drug, but could mean she had taken it at a later time. Effects of the drug vary, depending on the individual and the dosage, but one thing was clear. That night, she was fully aware of what was happening. Victim had been stabbed 28 times. Wojtek Frykowski, male Caucasian, 32 years, 5'10", 165 pounds, blonde hair, blue eyes. Frykowski had been living with Abigail Folger in a common-law relationship. Wojtek, Roman Polanski would later tell reporters, was a man of little talent but immense charm. The two had been friends in Poland, Frykowski's father reputedly having helped finance one of Polanski's early films. Even in Poland, Frykowski had been known as a playboy. According to fellow émigrés, he had once taken on and rendered inoperative two members of the secret police, which may have had something to do with his exit from Poland in 1967. He had married twice and had one son who had remained behind when he moved to Paris. Both there and later in New York, Polanski had given him money and encouragement, hopeful, but knowing Wojtek well, not too optimistic, that one of his grand plans would come through. None ever quite did. He told people that he was a writer, but no one could recall having read anything he had written. Friends of Abigail Folger told the police that Frykowski had introduced her to drugs so as to keep her under his control. Friends of Wojtek Frykowski said the opposite, that Folger had provided the drugs so as not to lose him. According to the police report, he had no means of support and lived off Folger's fortune. He used cocaine, mescaline, LSD, marijuana, hashish in large amounts. He was an extrovert and gave invitations to almost everyone he met to come visit him at his residence. Narcotic parties were the order of the day. He had fought hard for his life. Victim was shot twice, struck over the head 13 times with a blunt object, and stabbed 51 times. Stephen Earl Parent, male Caucasian, 18 years, 6 feet, 175 pounds, red hair, brown eyes. He had graduated from Arroyo High School in June, dated several girls, but no one in particular, had a full-time job as delivery boy for a plumbing company, plus a part-time job evenings as salesman for a stereo shop, holding down the two jobs so he could save money to attend junior college that September. Victim had one defensive slash wound and had been shot 4 times. During the fluoroscopy examination that preceded the Sebring autopsy, Dr. Noguchi discovered a bullet lodged between Sebring's back and his shirt. 3 more bullets were found during the autopsies, 1 in Frykowski's body, 2 in Parent's. These, plus the slug and fragments found in Parent's automobile, were turned over to Sergeant William Lee, Firearms and Explosives Unit, SID, for study. Lee concluded that all the bullets had probably been fired from the same gun and that they were .22 caliber. While the autopsies were in progress, Sergeants Paul Whiteley and Charles Gunther, two homicide detectives from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, approached Sergeant Jess Buckles, one of the Los Angeles Police Department detectives assigned to the Tate homicides, and told him something very curious. On July 31st, they had gone to 964 Old Topanga Road in Malibu to investigate a report of a possible homicide. They had found the body of Gary Hinman, a 34-year-old music teacher. He had been stabbed to death. The curious thing? As in the Tate homicides, a message had been left at the scene. On the wall in the living room, not far from Hinman's body, were the words, "Political Piggy," printed in the victim's own blood. Whiteley also told Buckles that they had arrested a suspect in connection with the murder, one Robert Bobby Beausoleil, a young hippie musician. He had been driving a car that belonged to Hinman. There was blood on his shirt and trousers, and a knife had been found hidden in the tire well of the vehicle. The arrest had occurred on August 6th. Therefore, he had been in custody at the time of the Tate homicides. However, it was possible that he hadn't been the only one involved in the Hinman murder. Beausoleil had been living at Spahn's Ranch, an old movie ranch near the Los Angeles suburb of Chatsworth, with a bunch of other hippies. It was an odd group, their leader, a guy named Charlie, apparently having convinced them that he was Jesus Christ. Buckles, Whiteley would later recall, lost interest when he mentioned hippies. "Nah," he replied, "we know what's behind these murders. They're part of a big dope transaction." Whiteley again emphasized the odd similarities, like mode of death. In both cases, a message had been left, both printed, both in a victim's blood, and in both the letters "pig" appeared. Any one of these things would be highly unusual, but all. The odds against its being a coincidence must be astronomical. Sergeant Buckles, LAPD, told Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther, LASO, "If you don't hear from us in a week or so, that means we're on to something else." A little more than 24 hours after the discovery of the Tate victims, the Los Angeles Police Department was given a lead by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, which, if followed, could possibly have broken the case. Buckles never did call, nor did he think the information important enough to walk across the autopsy room and mention the conversation to his superior, Lieutenant Robert Helder, who was in charge of the Tate investigation. At Lieutenant Helder's suggestion, Dr. Noguchi withheld specifics when he met with the press. He did not mention the number of wounds, nor did he say anything about two of the victims having ingested drugs. He did again deny the already much repeated reports that there had been sexual molestation and/or mutilation. Neither was true, he stressed. Asked about Sharon's child, he said that Mrs. Polanski was in the 8th month of her pregnancy, that the child was a perfectly formed boy, and that had he been removed by post-mortem cesarean within the first 20 minutes after the mother's death, his life probably could have been saved. But by the time the bodies were discovered, it was too late. Lieutenant Helder also talked to the press that day. Yes, Gerritsen was still in custody. No, he could not comment on the evidence against him, except to say that the police were now investigating his acquaintances. Pressed further, Helder admitted, "There's no solid information that will limit us to a single suspect. It could have been one man. It could have been two. It could have been three." "But," he added, "I don't feel that we have a maniac running around." Lieutenant A.H. Burdick began the polygraph examination of William Gerritsen at 4:25 that afternoon at Parker Center. Burdick did not immediately hook up Gerritsen. In accordance with routine, the initial portion of the examination was conversational, the examiner attempting to put the suspect at ease while eliciting as much background information as possible. Though obviously frightened, Gerritsen loosened up a little as he talked. He told Burdick that he was 19, from Ohio, and had been hired by Rudy Altobelli in March, just before Altobelli left for Europe. His job was simple: to look after the guest house and Altobelli's three dogs. In return, he had been given a place to stay, $35 a week, and the promise of an airline ticket back to Ohio when Altobelli returned. He had little to do with the people who lived in the main house, Gerritsen claimed. Several of his replies seemed to bear this out. He still referred to Frykowski, for example, as the younger Polanski, while he appeared unfamiliar with Sebring, either by name or description, though he had seen the black Porsche in the driveway on several occasions. Asked to relate his activities prior to the murders, Gerritsen said that on Thursday night an acquaintance had dropped by, accompanied by his girl. They had brought along a six-pack of beer and some pot. Gerritsen was sure it was Thursday night, as the man was married, and he brought her up there several other times, you know, on Thursday, when his wife lets him go out. Question: did they use your pad? Answer: yes, they did, and I drank some beer while they made out. Gerritsen recalled that he drank 4 beers, smoked 2 joints, took 1 Dexedrine, and was sick all day Friday. About 8:30 or 9 p.m. Friday, Gerritsen said, he went down to the Sunset Strip to buy a pack of cigarettes and a TV dinner. He guessed the time of his return at about 10, but couldn't be sure, not having a watch. As he passed the main house, he noticed the lights were on, but he didn't see anyone, nor did he observe anything out of the ordinary. Then, about 11:45 or something like that, Steve Parent came up and, you know, he brought his radio with him. He had a radio, clock radio, and I didn't expect him or anything, and he asked me how I'd been and everything. Parent plugged in the radio to demonstrate how it worked, but Gerritsen wasn't interested. Then I gave him a beer, and he drank it, and then he called somebody on Santa Monica and Doheny, and he said that he would be going there, and so then he left, and, you know, that's the last time I saw him. When found in Parent's car, the clock radio had stopped at 12:15 a.m., the approximate time of the murder. Although it could have been a remarkable coincidence, the logical presumption was that Parent had set it while demonstrating it to Gerritsen, then unplugged it just before he left. This would coincide with Gerritsen's estimate of the time. According to Gerritsen, after Parent left, he wrote some letters and played the stereo, not going to sleep until just before dawn. Though he claimed to have heard nothing unusual during the night, he admitted that he had been scared. Why? Burdick asked. Well, Gerritsen replied, not long after Steve left, he noticed that the handle of the door was turned down, as if someone had tried to open it. And when he tried to use the phone to learn the time, he found it was dead. Like the other officers, Burdick found it difficult to believe that Gerritsen, though admittedly awake all night, heard nothing, while neighbors even farther away heard shots or screams. Gerritsen insisted, however, that he had neither heard nor seen anything. He was less sure on another point, whether he had gone out into the backyard when he let Altobelli's dogs out. To Burdick, he appeared evasive about this. From the yard, however, he couldn't see the main house, though he might have heard something. As far as LAPD was concerned, the moment of truth was now arriving. Burdick began setting up the polygraph, at the same time reading Gerritsen the list of questions he intended to ask. This, too, was standard operating procedure, and more than a little psychological. Knowing a certain question was going to be asked, but not when, built tension, accentuating the response. He then began the test. Question: is your true last name Gerritsen? Answer: yes. No significant response. Question: concerning Steve, did you cause his death? Answer: no. Facing forward, Gerritsen couldn't see Burdick's face. Burdick kept his voice matter-of-fact as he moved on to the next question, in no way indicating that the steel pens had jerked across the graph. Question: you understand the questions? Answer: yes. Question: do you feel responsible for Steve's death? Answer: that he even knew me, yes. Question: huh? Answer: that he even knew me. I mean, he wouldn't have come up that night, and nothing would have happened, in other words, to him. Burdick relieved the pressure cup on Gerritsen's arm, told him to relax, talked to him informally for a while. Then again, the pressure and the questions, only slightly changed this time. Question: is your true last name Gerritsen? Answer: yes. Question: did you shoot Steve? Answer: no. No significant response. More test questions, followed by, do you know who caused Mrs. Polanski's death? Answer: no. Question: did you cause Mrs. Polanski's death? Answer: no. Still no significant response. Burdick now accepted Gerritsen's explanation that he felt responsibility for Perrin's death but had no part in causing it or the other murders. The examination went on for another half hour or so, during which Burdick closed off several avenues of investigation. Gerritsen was not gay. He had never had sex with any of the victims. He had never sold drugs. There was no indication that Gerritsen was lying, but he remained nervous throughout. Burdick asked him why. Gerritsen explained that when he was being taken to his cell, a policeman had pointed at him, saying, "There's the guy that killed all those people." Question: I would imagine it would shake you up, but that doesn't mean you're lying. Answer: no, I'm just confused. Question: why are you confused? Answer: for one thing, how come I wasn't murdered? Question: I don't know. Although legally inadmissible as evidence, the police believe in the polygraph. In 1972, a Los Angeles Superior Court judge broke with precedent and permitted the results of a polygraph test to be received into evidence in a marijuana case. Though uninformed of it at the time, Gerritsen had passed. At the conclusion of the examination, Captain Don Martin, Commander SID, wrote in his official report, "It was the examiner's opinion that Mr. Gerritsen was truthful and not criminally involved in the Polanski homicides." Unofficially, though Burdick believed Gerritsen clean on participation, he felt he was a little muddy on knowledge. It was possible that he had heard something, then, fearful, hidden until dawn. This was just conjecture, however. For all intents and purposes, with the polygraph, William Esten Gerritsen ceased to be a good suspect. Yet that bothersome question remained. Every single human being at 10,050 Cielo Drive had been slaughtered, save one. Why? Because there was no immediate answer, and certainly in part because, having been the only warm body on the premises, he had seemed such a likely suspect, Gerritsen was held for another day. That same Sunday, Gerald D. Friedman, a UCLA student, contacted the police and informed them that the call Stephen Parent made at approximately 11:45 on Friday night had been to him. Parent was going to build a stereo set for Friedman, and he wanted to talk over the details. Friedman had tried to beg off, saying it was late, but finally gave in and told Parent he could drop by for a few minutes. Parent had asked him the time, and when he told him, said he would be there about 12:30. It was possible when Parent asked the time, he also set the radio clock. According to Friedman, he never got there. That Sunday, LAPD not only lost their best suspect to date, another promising lead fizzled out. Sharon Tate's red Ferrari, which the police had thought might have been used as a getaway car, was located in a Beverly Hills garage where Sharon had taken it the previous week for repairs. That evening, Roman Polanski returned from London. Reporters who saw him at the airport described him as terribly crushed and beaten by the tragedy. Though he refused to talk with the press, a spokesman for him denied there was any truth to the rumors of a marital rift. Polanski had remained in London, he said, because he hadn't finished his work there. Sharon had returned home early by boat because of airline restrictions against travel during the last 2 months of pregnancy. Polanski was taken to an apartment inside the Paramount lot, where he remained in seclusion under a doctor's care. The police talked to him briefly that night, but he was at that time unable to suggest anyone with a motive for the murders. Frank Struthers also returned to Los Angeles that Sunday night. About 8:30 p.m., the Saffies dropped him off at the end of the long driveway leading to the LaBianca residence. Lugging his suitcase and camping equipment up the driveway, the 15-year-old noticed that the speedboat was still on the trailer behind Leno's Thunderbird. That seemed odd. His stepfather didn't like to leave the boat out overnight. Stowing his equipment in the garage, he went to the back door of the residence. Only then did he notice that all the window shades had been pulled down. He couldn't recall ever seeing them that way before, and it frightened him just a little bit. The light was on in the kitchen, and he knocked on the door. There was no response. He called out. Again, no answer. Really upset now, he walked to the closest payphone, which was at a hamburger stand at Hyperion and Rowena. He dialed the number of the house, then, getting no response, tried to reach his sister at the restaurant where she worked. Suzanne wasn't working that night, but the manager offered to try her apartment. Frank gave him the number of the payphone. Shortly after 9, she called. She hadn't seen or heard from their mother and stepfather since they had dropped her off at her apartment the previous night. Telling Frank to remain where he was, she called her boyfriend, Joe Dorgan, and told him Frank thought something was wrong at the house. About 9:30, Joe and Suzanne picked up Frank at the hamburger stand, the three driving directly to 3301 Waverly Drive. Rosemary often left a set of house keys in her own car. They found them and opened the back door. Since no one tried the door before using the key, it is unknown whether it was locked. Dorgan suggested that Suzanne remain in the kitchen while he and Frank checked out the rest of the house. They proceeded through the dining room. When they got to the living room, they saw Leno. He was sprawled on his back between the couch and a chair. There was a throw pillow over his head, some kind of cord around his neck, and the tops of his pajamas were torn open so his stomach was bare. Something was protruding from his stomach. He was so still, they knew he was dead. Afraid Suzanne would follow and see what they had, they returned to the kitchen. Joe picked up the kitchen phone to call the police, then, worried that he might be disturbing evidence, put it back down, telling Suzanne, "Everything's okay. Let's get out of here." But Suzanne knew everything wasn't okay. On the refrigerator door, someone had written something in what looked like red paint. Hurrying back down the driveway, they stopped at a duplex across the street, and Dorgan rang the bell of 3308 Waverly Drive. The peephole opened. Dorgan said there had been a stabbing and he wanted to call the police. The person inside refused to open the door, saying, "We'll call the police for you." LAPD's switchboard logged the call at 10:26 p.m., the caller complaining about some juveniles making a disturbance. Unsure whether the person had really made the call, Dorgan had already pushed the bell of the other apartment, 3306. Dr. and Mrs. Mary J. Brigham let the three young people in. However, they were so upset Mrs. Brigham had to complete the call. At 10:35, Unit 6A39, a black and white manned by officers W.C. Rodriguez and J.C. Tony was dispatched to the address, arriving very quickly, 5 to 7 minutes later. While Suzanne and Frank remained with the doctor and his wife, Dorgan accompanied the two Hollywood Division officers to the LaBianca residence. Tony covered the back door while Rodriguez went around the house. The front door was closed, but not locked. After one look inside, he ran back to the car and called for a backup unit, a supervisor, and an ambulance. Rodriguez had been on the force only 14 months. He had never discovered a body before. Within a few minutes, Ambulance Unit G1 arrived, and Leno LaBianca was pronounced DOA, dead on arrival. In addition to the pillow Frank and Joe had seen, there was a bloody pillowcase over his head. The cord around his neck was attached to a massive lamp. The cord knotted so tightly it appeared he had been throttled with it. His hands were tied behind his back with a leather thong. The object protruding from his stomach was an ivory-handled, bi-tined carving fork. In addition to a number of stab wounds in the abdomen, someone had carved the letters W.A.R. in the naked flesh. The backup unit, 6L40, manned by Sergeant Edward L. Klein, arrived just after the ambulance. A veteran of 16 years, Klein took charge, obtaining a pink DOA slip from the two attendants before they left. The pair were already on their way down the driveway when Rodriguez called them back. Klein had found another body in the master bedroom. Rosemary LaBianca was lying face down on the bedroom floor, parallel to the bed and dresser, in a large pool of blood. She was wearing a short pink nightgown, and over it an expensive dress, blue with white horizontal stripes, which Suzanne would later identify as one of her mother's favorites. Both nightgown and dress were bunched up over her head, so her back, buttocks, and legs were bare. Klein didn't even try to count the stab wounds, there were so many. Her hands were not tied, but, like Leno, she had a pillowcase over her head and a lamp cord was wrapped around her neck. The cord was attached to one of a pair of bedroom lamps, both of which had overturned. The tautness of the cord, plus a second pool of blood about 2 feet from the body, indicated that perhaps she had tried to crawl, pulling the lamps over while doing so. A second pink DOA slip was filled out for Mrs. Rosemary LaBianca. Joe Dorgan had to tell Suzanne and Frank. There was writing, in what appeared to be blood, in 3 places in the residence. High up on the north wall in the living room, above several paintings, were printed the words, "Death to Pigs." On the south wall, to the left of the front door, even higher up, was the single word, "Rise." There were 2 words on the refrigerator door in the kitchen, the first of which was misspelled. They read, "Helter Skelter." Monday, August 11th, 1969. At 12:15 a.m., the case was assigned to robbery-homicide. Sergeant Danny Galindo, who had spent the previous night on guard duty at the Tate residence, was the first detective to arrive at about 1 a.m. He was joined shortly after by Inspector K.J. McCauley and several other detectives, while an additional unit, ordered by Klein, sealed off the grounds. As with the Tate homicides, however, the reporters, who had already begun to arrive, apparently had little difficulty obtaining inside information. Galindo made a detailed search of the one-story residence. Except for the overturned lamps, there were no signs of a struggle, nor was there any evidence that robbery had been the motive. Among the items that Galindo would log into the county public administrator's report were a man's gold ring, the main stone a 1-carat diamond, the other stones also diamonds, only slightly smaller. 2 woman's rings, both expensive, both in plain view on a dresser in the bedroom. Necklaces, bracelets, camera equipment, handguns, shotguns and rifles, a coin collection, a bag of uncirculated nickels found in the trunk of Lino's Thunderbird, worth considerably more than their $400 face value. Lino LaBianca's wallet, with credit cards and cash in the glove compartment of his car. Several watches, one a high-priced stopwatch of the type used to clock racehorses, plus numerous other easily fenced items. Several days later, Frank Struthers returned to the residence with the police. The only missing items, as far as he could determine, were Rosemary's wallet and her wristwatch. Galindo was unable to find any indications of forced entry. However, testing the back door, he found it could be jimmied very easily. He was able to open it with only a strip of celluloid. The detectives made a number of other discoveries. The ivory-handled carving fork found protruding from Lino's stomach belonged to a set found in a kitchen drawer. There were some watermelon rinds in the sink. There were also blood splatters, both there and in the rear bathroom, and a piece of blood-soaked paper was found on the floor in the dining room, its frayed end suggesting that possibly it had been the instrument used to print the words. In many ways, the activities at 3301 Waverly Drive the rest of that night were a replay of those that had occurred at 10050 Cielo Drive less than 48 hours earlier. even to, in some cases, the same cast, with Sergeant Joe Granado arriving about 3 a.m. to take blood samples. The sample from the kitchen sink wasn't sufficient to determine if it was animal or human, but all the other samples tested positive on the Octoloni test, indicating they were human blood. The blood in the rear bathroom, as well as all the blood in the vicinity of Rosemary LaBianca's body, was type A, Rosemary LaBianca's type. All the other samples, including that taken from the rumpled paper and the various writings, were type B, Lino LaBianca's type. This time, Granado didn't take any subtypes. The fingerprint men from SID, Sergeants Harold Dolan and Jay Claiborne, lifted a total of 25 latents, all but six of which would later be identified as belonging to Lena, Rosemary, or Frank. It was apparent to Dolan, from examining those areas where fingerprints should have been but weren't, that an effort had been made to eradicate prints. For example, there was not even a smudge on the ivory handle of the carving fork, on the chrome handle of the refrigerator door, or on the enamel finish of the door itself, all surfaces that readily lent themselves to receiving latent fingerprints. The refrigerator door, on close examination, showed white marks. After the police photographer had finished, a deputy coroner supervised the removal of the bodies. The pillowcases were left in place over the heads of the victims. The lamp cords were cut near the bases, so the knots remained intact for study. A representative of the Animal Regulation Department removed the three dogs, which, when the first officers arrived, had been found inside the house. Left behind were the puzzle pieces, but this time at least a partial pattern was discernible in the similarities. Los Angeles, California, consecutive nights, multiple murders, victims affluent Caucasians, multiple stab wounds, incredible savagery, absence of a conventional motive, no evidence of ransacking or robbery, ropes around the neck of two Tate victims, cords around the necks of both LaBiancas, and the bloody printing. Yet within 24 hours, the police would decide there was no connection between the two sets of murders. Second ritual killings here. Los Feliz couple slain. Link to five-way murder scene. The headlines screamed from the front pages that Monday morning. TV programs were interrupted for updates. To the millions of Angelenos who commuted to work via the freeways, their car radios seemed to broadcast little else. Some of the details were garbled. It was reported, for example, that the pillowcases were white hoods, that the phrase "death to pigs" had been printed in blood on the refrigerator door when it actually appeared on a wall in the living room. But enough information had leaked out for the detectives again to have trouble finding polygraph keys. It was then the fear began. When the news of the Tate homicides broke, even those acquainted with the victims were less fearful than shocked, for simultaneously came the announcement that a suspect had been arrested and charged with the murders. Gerritsen, however, had been in custody when these new murders took place, and with his release that Monday, still looking as puzzled and frightened as when the police captured him, the panic began and spread. If Gerritsen wasn't guilty, then it meant that whoever was still at large. If it could happen in places as widely separated as Los Feliz and Bel Air, to people as disparate as movie colony celebrities and a grocery market owner and his wife, it meant it could happen anywhere, to anyone. Sometimes fear can be measured. Among the barometers, in 2 days, one Beverly Hills sporting goods store sold 200 firearms. Prior to the murders, they averaged 3 or 4 a day. Some of the private security forces doubled, then tripled their personnel. Guard dogs, once priced at $200, now sold for $1,500. Those who supplied them soon ran out. Locksmiths quoted 2-week delays on orders. Accidental shootings, suspicious persons reports, all suddenly increased. The news that there had been 28 murders in Los Angeles that weekend, the average being 1 a day, did nothing to decrease the apprehension. It was reported that Frank Sinatra was in hiding, that Mia Farrow wouldn't attend her friend Sharon's funeral because, a relative explained, Mia is afraid she will be next, that Tony Bennett had moved from his bungalow on the grounds of the Beverly Hills Hotel to an inside suite for greater security, that Steve McQueen now kept a weapon under the front seat of his sports car, that Jerry Lewis had installed an alarm system in his home, complete with closed-circuit TV. Connie Stevens later admitted she had turned her Beverly Hills home into a fortress, mainly because of the Sharon Tate murders. That scared the daylights out of everyone. Friendships ended, romances broke up, people were abruptly dropped from guest lists, parties canceled, for with the fear came suspicion. The killer, or killers, could be almost anyone. A cloud of fright hung over Southern California more dense than its smog. It would not dissipate for months. As late as the following March, William Clowman would write in Esquire, "In the great houses of Bel Air, terror sends people flying to their telephones when a branch falls from a tree outside." Political Piggy, Hinman. Pig, Tate. Death to Pigs, LaBianca. In each case, written in the blood of one of the victims. Sergeant Buckles still didn't think it important enough to check further. Deputy Medical Examiner David Katsuyama conducted the LaBianca autopsies. Before starting, he removed the pillowcases from the heads of the victims. Only then was it discovered that in addition to the carving fork embedded in his abdomen, a knife had been stuck in Lino LaBianca's throat. Since none of the personnel at the scene had observed the knife, this became one of the LaBianca polygraph keys. There were two others. For some reason, though the phrase "death to pigs" had leaked to the press, neither Rise nor Helter Skelter had. Lino A. LaBianca, 3301 Waverly Drive, male Caucasian, 44 years, 6 feet, 220 pounds, brown eyes, brown hair. Born in Los Angeles, son of the founder of the State Wholesale Grocery Company, Lino had gone into the family business after attending the University of Southern California, eventually becoming president of Gateway Markets, a Southern California chain. As far as the police were able to determine, Lino had no enemies, yet they soon discovered that he, too, had a secret side. Friends and relatives described him as quiet and conservative. They were amazed to learn, after his death, that he owned 9 thoroughbred racehorses, the most prominent being Kildare Lady, and that he was a chronic gambler, frequenting the tracks nearly every racing day, often betting $500 at a time. Nor did they know that he was, at the time of his death, some $230,000 in debt. In the weeks ahead, the LaBianca detectives would do a remarkable job of tracking their way through the tangled maze of Lino LaBianca's complex financial affairs. The possibility that Lino might have been the victim of loan sharks, however, fell apart when it was learned that Rosemary LaBianca was quite wealthy herself, having more than sufficient assets to pay off Lino's debts. One of Lino's former partners, also Italian, who knew of his gambling habits, told the police he thought the murders might have been committed by the mafia. He admitted he had no evidence to support this. However, the detectives did learn that for a short time Lino had been on the board of directors of a Hollywood bank, which LAPD and LASO intelligence units believed was backed by hoodlum money. They had been unable to prove this, though several other board members were indicted and convicted of a kiting scheme. The possibility of a mafia link became one of a number of leads that would have to be checked out. Lino did not have a criminal record. Rosemary had 1 traffic citation, which dated back to 1957. Lino left $100,000 in insurance, which, since it was to be divided equally among Suzanne, Frank, and the 3 children from his previous marriage, appeared to rule that out as a motive. Lino LaBianca died in the same house in which he had been born, he and Rosemary moving into the family home, which Lino had purchased from his mother in November 1968. Cause of death: multiple stab wounds. Victim had 12 stab wounds plus 14 puncture wounds made by a double-tined fork, for a total of 26 separate wounds, any one of six of which could, in and of itself, have been fatal. Rosemary LaBianca, 3301 Waverly Drive, female Caucasian, 38 years, 5'5", 125 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes. It was probable that even Rosemary did not know a great deal about her early years. It was believed that she had been born in Mexico of American parents, then orphaned or abandoned in Arizona. She remained in an orphanage there until the age of 12, when she was adopted by a family named Harmon, who took her to California. She had met her first husband while working as a car hop at the Brown Derby Drive-In in Los Feliz in the late 1940s, while still in her teens. They were divorced in 1958, and it was shortly after this, while working as a waitress at the Los Feliz Inn, that she met and married Lino LaBianca. Her former husband was polygraphed and cleared of any involvement in the crime. Former employers, ex-boyfriends, current business associates were interviewed. None could recall anyone who disliked her. According to Ruth Civic, her partner in boutique carriage, Rosemary had a good head for business. Not only was the shop successful, Rosemary also invested in stocks and commodities and did well. How well was not known until her estate was probated, and it was learned she had left $2,600,000. Abigail Folger, the heiress in the Cielo slayings, had left less than one-fifth that. Mrs. Civic had last seen Rosemary on Friday when they went buying for the store. Rosemary had called on Saturday morning, telling her they planned to drive to Lake Isabella and wondering if she could drop by that afternoon and feed the dogs. The LaBiancas had three dogs. All had barked loudly when she approached the house at about 6 p.m. After feeding them, taking the dog food out of the refrigerator, Mrs. Civic checked the doors. All were locked and left. Mrs. Civic's testimony established that whoever wiped the refrigerator handle of prints had done so sometime after she had been there. Rosemary LaBianca, car hop to millionaires to murder victim. Cause of death? Multiple stab wounds. Victim had been stabbed a total of 41 times, any one of six of which could, in and of itself, have been fatal. All but one of Lino LaBianca's wounds were to the front of his body. 36 of the 41 inflicted on Rosemary LaBianca were to her back and buttocks. Lino had no defensive wounds, indicating that his hands had probably been bound before he was stabbed. Rosemary had a defensive slash wound on her left jaw. This wound, plus the knife in Lino's throat, indicated that the placing of the pillowcases over the heads of the victims was a belated act, possibly even occurring after they had died. The pillowcases were identified as the LaBianca's own, having been removed from the two pillows on their bed. The knife found in Lino's throat was also theirs. Though it was from a different set than the fork, it matched others found in a kitchen drawer. The dimensions of its blade were length, 4 7/8 inches, thickness just under 1/16 inch, width at widest point, 13/16 inch, width at narrowest point, 3/8 inch. The LaBianca detectives later noted in their report, the knife recovered from his throat appeared to be the weapon used in both homicides. It was a presumption, and nothing more, since for some reason Dr. Katsuyama, unlike his superior Dr. Noguchi, who handled the Tate autopsies, did not measure the dimensions of the wounds, nor did the detectives assigned to the LaBianca case ask for these statistics. The ramifications of this one presumption were immense. A single weapon indicated that there was probably a single killer. That the weapon used belonged in the residence meant that the killer had probably arrived unarmed, his decision to kill the pair occurring sometime after he entered the premises. This in turn suggested, 1, that the killer had arrived to commit a burglary or some other crime, then had been surprised when the LaBiancas returned home, or 2, that the victims knew the killer, trusting him enough to let him in at 2 in the morning or thereafter. One little presumption, but it would cause many, many problems later, as would the estimated time of death. Asked by the detectives to determine the time, Katsuyama came up with 3 p.m. Sunday. When other evidence appeared to contradict this, the detectives went back to Katsuyama and asked him to recalculate. He now decided Lino LaBianca had died sometime between 12:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. on Sunday, and that Rosemary had died an hour earlier. However, Katsuyama cautioned the time could be affected by room temperature and other variables. All this was so indecisive that the detectives simply ignored it. They knew from Frank Struthers that Lino was a creature of habit. Every night he bought the paper, then read it before going to bed, always starting with the sports section. That section had been open on the coffee table, with Lino's reading glasses beside it. From this and other evidence, Lino was wearing pajamas, the bed hadn't yet been slept in, and so forth, they concluded that the murders had probably taken place within an hour or so after the LaBiancas had left Fociano's newsstand, or sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. on Sunday. As early as Monday, police were minimizing the similarities between the two crimes. Inspector K.J. McCauley told reporters, "I don't see any connection between this murder and the others. They're too widely removed. I just don't see any connection." Sergeant Bryce Houchin observed, "There is a similarity, but whether it's the same suspect or a copycat, we just don't know." There were several reasons for discounting the similarities. One was the absence of any apparent link between the victims, another the distance between the crimes. Still another, and more important in formulating a motive, drugs were found at 10,050 Cielo Drive, while there were none at 3301 Waverly Drive. There was one more reason, perhaps the most influential. Even before Gerritsen was released, the Tate detectives had not one, but several very promising new suspects. August 12th to 15th, 1969. From William Tennant, Roman Polanski's business manager, LAPD learned that in mid-March the Polanskis had given a catered party at Cielo with over 100 guests. As at any large Hollywood gathering, there were crashers, among them plus Herb Wilson, plus Larry Madigan, and plus Jeffrey Pickett, nicknamed Pick. Everything in this book is based on fact. In a few instances, the names of persons only tangentially involved have been changed for legal reasons, the plus indicating the substitution of a pseudonym for the true name. The persons were and are real, however, and the incidents depicted are entirely factual. The trio, all in their late 20s, were reputedly dope dealers. During the party, Wilson apparently stepped on Tennant's foot. An argument ensued, Madigan and Pickett taking Wilson's side. Irritated, Roman Polanski had the three men evicted. It was a minor incident, in and of itself hardly cause for 5 savage murders, but Tennant had heard something else. Pick had once threatened to kill Frykowski. This information had come to him through a friend of Wojtek's, Witold Katanowski, an artist professionally known as Witold K. Not unmindful of the similarity between Pick and the bloody lettered pig on the front door of the Tate residence, detectives interviewed Witold K. From him they learned that after the Polanskis had left for Europe, Wilson, Pickett, Madigan, and a fourth man, plus Gerald Jones, were frequent visitors to the Cielo residence, Wilson and Madigan, according to Witold, supplying Wojtek and Gibby with most of their drugs, including the MDA they had taken before they died. As for Jeffrey Pickett, when Gibby and Wojtek took over Cielo, he moved into their Woodstock residence. Witold was staying there also. Once, during an argument, Pickett tried to strangle the artist. When Wojtek learned of this, he told Pickett to get out. Enraged, Pick swore, "I'll kill them all, and Wojtek will be the first." Numerous others also felt one or more of the men might be involved and passed on their suspicions to the police. John and Michelle Phillips, formerly of the Mamas and Papas group and friends of four of the five Tate victims, said Wilson once drew a gun on Wojtek. Various Strip habitués claimed Wilson often bragged that he was a hired killer, that Jones was an expert with knives, always carrying one for throwing, and that Madigan was Sebring's candyman, or cocaine source. More than ever convinced that the Tate homicides were the results of a drug burn or freakout, LAPD began looking for Wilson, Madigan, Pickett, and Jones. For 10 years, Sharon Tate had sought stardom. Now she attained it in just 3 days. On Tuesday, August 12th, her name moved from the headlines onto theater marquees. Valley of the Dolls was re-released nationally, opening in more than a dozen theaters in the Los Angeles area alone. It was quickly followed by The Fearless Vampire Killers and other films in which the actress had appeared, the only difference being that now she was given star billing. That same day, the police told reporters that they had officially ruled out any connection between the Tate and LaBianca homicides. According to the Los Angeles Times, several officers indicated they were inclined to believe the second slayings were the work of a copycat. From the start, the two investigations had proceeded separately, with different detectives assigned to each. They would continue this way, each team pursuing its own leads. They had one thing in common, though that similarity widened the distance between them. Both were operating on a basic assumption. In nearly 90% of all homicides, the victim knows his killer. In both investigations, the chief focus was now on acquaintances of the victims. In checking out the mafia rumor, the LaBianca detectives interviewed each of Lino's known business associates. All doubted the murders were mafia originated. One man told the detectives that if the mafia had been responsible, he probably would have heard about it. It was a thorough investigation, the detectives even checking to see if the San Diego company where Lino had purchased his speedboat during their 1968 vacation was mafia-financed. It wasn't, though numerous other businesses in the Mission Bay area were allegedly backed by Jewish mafia money. They even questioned Lino's mother, who told them he was a good boy. He never did belong to the association. The elimination of a possible mafia link, however, did not leave the LaBianca detectives without a suspect. In questioning neighbors of the pair, they learned that the house to the east, 3267 Waverly Drive, was vacant and had been for several months. Prior to that, it had been a hippie hangout. The hippies didn't interest them, but another former tenant, plus Fred Gardner, did very much. From his rap sheet and from interviews, they learned that Gardner, a young attorney, has had mental problems in the past and claims he blacks out for periods of time and is not responsible for his actions. During an argument with his father, he grabbed a knife from the kitchen table and chased his father, stating that he would kill him. In September 1968, after being married only 2 weeks, for no apparent reason, he administered a vicious beating to his wife, then grabbed a knife from the kitchen drawer and attempted to kill her. She warded off the blows and managed to escape and call the police. Booked for attempted murder, he was examined by a court-appointed psychiatrist who found he had uncontrolled aggressions of maniacal proportions. Despite this, the charge had been reduced to simple assault. He was released on probation and returned to the practice of law. Since then, Gardner had been arrested a number of times on drunk or drug charges. Following his last arrest for forging a prescription, he was released on $900 bail and promptly skipped. A warrant for his arrest had been issued on August 1st, 9 days before the LaBianca murders. He was believed to be in New York. When the officers questioned Gardner's ex-wife, she told them she could recall 7 separate occasions when Gardner visited the LaBiancas, each time returning with either money or whiskey. When she'd asked him about this, he'd allegedly replied, "It's okay. I know them, and they had better give it to me or else." Had Gardner, with his penchant for kitchen knives, again tried to put the bite on the LaBiancas, this time the couple saying no. The officers contacted an FBI agent in New York to see if he could determine Gardner's present whereabouts. Beloved wife of Roman, Sharon Tate Polanski, 1943-1969, Paul Richard Polanski, their baby. Wednesday was a day of funerals. More than 150 persons attended Sharon Tate's last rites at Holy Cross Cemetery. Among those present were Kirk Douglas, Warren Beatty, Steve McQueen, James Coburn, Lee Marvin, Yul Brynner, Peter Sellers, John and Michelle Phillips. Roman Polanski, wearing dark glasses and accompanied by his doctor, broke down several times during the ceremony, as did Sharon's parents and her two young sisters, Patricia and Deborah. Many of the same people, including Polanski, later attended the services for Jay Sebring at Wee Kirk of the Heather, Forest Lawn. Additional celebrities included Paul Newman, Henry and Peter Fonda, Alex Cord, and George Hamilton, all former Sebring clients. There were fewer people and fewer flashbulbs as, across the city, six of his high school classmates carried Stephen Parent's body from the small El Monte Church where his services had taken place. Abigail Folger was buried near where she had grown up in Northern California on the San Francisco Peninsula, following a requiem mass in Our Lady of the Wayside Church, which had been built by her grandparents. Wojtek Frykowski's body remained in Los Angeles until relatives in Poland could arrange for it to be returned there for burial. While the Tate victims were being interred, the police were attempting to recreate their lives, in particular, their last day. Friday, August 8th. About 8 a.m., Mrs. Chapman arrived at Cielo. She did what dishes there were, then commenced her regular household chores. About 8:30, Frank Guerrero arrived to paint the room at the north end of the residence. This was to be the nursery. Before starting, Guerrero removed the screens from the windows. At 11 a.m., Roman Polanski called from London. Mrs. Chapman overheard Sharon's side of the conversation. Sharon was worried that Roman wouldn't be home in time for his birthday, August 18th. He apparently assured her that he would be back on August 12th as planned, as Sharon later told Mrs. Chapman this. Sharon informed Roman that she had enrolled him in a course for expectant fathers. Sharon received several other calls, one of them having to do with a neighbor's kitten that had strayed onto the property. Sharon had been feeding it with an eyedropper. When Terry Melcher had moved out, he'd left behind a number of cats, Sharon promising to look after them. They had since multiplied, and Sharon was caring for all 26, plus two dogs, hers and Abigail's. Most of the day, Sharon wore only bikini panties and a bra. This, according to Mrs. Chapman, was her usual at-home attire in hot weather. Shortly before noon, Mrs. Chapman, noticing that there were paw prints and dog splatters on the front door, washed down the whole exterior with vinegar and water. A small detail, which later would become extremely important. Steve Parent had lunch at his home in El Monte. Before returning to work at the plumbing supply company, he asked his mother if she would lay out clean clothes so he could make a quick change before going to his second job at the stereo shop later that afternoon. About 12:30, two of Sharon's friends, Joanna Pettit, Mrs. Alex Cord, and Barbara Lewis, arrived at Cielo for lunch. Mrs. Chapman served them. It was all small talk, the women would later recall, mostly about the expected baby. Sharon showed the two women the nursery and introduced them to Guerrero. This would be actress Joanna Pettit's second close brush with violent death. She had also been a friend of Janice Wiley, who together with her roommate Emily Hoffert had been murdered in New York City in the summer of 1963 in what became known as the Career Girls murder case. About 1 p.m., Sandy Tennant called Sharon. As previously noted, Sharon told her she wasn't planning a party that evening, but did invite her to drop by. An invitation Sandy declined. If one believed all the subsequent talk, half of Hollywood was invited to 10,050 Cielo Drive for a party that night, and at the last minute changed their minds. According to Winifred Chapman, Sandy Tennant, Debbie Tate, and others,